You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey, y'all. This is Mark. Welcome to episode 85. The last show was all about Mardi Gras. Specifically, I was joined by a former king of carnival, Dr. Stephen Hales. We discussed the Rex Parade and its impact on Mardi Gras and more broadly on the city of New Orleans as a whole. It was a fun glimpse behind the scenes of the oldest parading organization in New Orleans. If you missed it, go back and give it a listen, then start planning your visit for next Mardi Gras. Today's episode is about bread, or should I say one man's passion about bread and changing the way we think about it. He's the founder of Bellegarde Bakery here in New Orleans, and if you love bread, you won't want to miss it. It'll change the way you think about that bag of flour sitting in your pantry. But before we jump into the discussion, a word from our sponsors. All visits to New Orleans, of course, start with figuring out where to stay. Let us help you by recommending the Old 77 Hotel. It's in a great location in the Warehouse District, just 3 blocks from the French Quarter. It's close to a lot of great places to eat and drink, and it's near the streetcar lines, too. I also love that they have a great seasonal art exhibit that's free. It's put together by Where You Art. Plus, they really help support local creators, including NOLA Boards, Chop Industries, and Sweet Olive Soapworks, not to mention this podcast. The Old Number 77 has a wide range of choices when it comes to rooms. Really, they have something for everyone. They have interior rooms for those that want any hint of daylight after a long night out. They also offer premium rooms and artist loft suites that are curated by New Orleans artists. There's a ton of choices for a small hotel. And if that wasn't enough, they have an award-winning restaurant, Compère Lapin, which, by the way, is a big supporter of today's subject, Bellegarde Bakery. The Old Number 77 is located at 535 Chapultepec Street. Use code BBOLD77 when you book a room and save 25%. Plus, you get a bit of lagniappe, a little something extra, in the form of a $10 credit at Toot La for coffee and stuff in the morning. Once you have your hotel booked, you need to figure out what to do, of course. And among the things on our first-time visitors list is a stroll through the Garden District. We think the best way to do that is on a tour, and one of our favorites is Two Chicks Walking Tours. Let Christine Miller and the team over there be your guide. They got you covered with a wonderful Garden District tour that provides plenty of history, along with fun facts about some of the neighborhood's residents, both past and present. See where Anne Rice lived, as well as the present-day homes of actor John Goodman and Saints legend Archie Manning, plus plenty more. By the way, we just finished up Mardi Gras, and several listeners spotted Peyton Manning along the route this year, just down the street from the house he and Eli grew up in. When you take a Two Chicks Walking Tour, you also get to learn about our cemeteries, because this tour includes Lafayette Cemetery, which is in the heart of the Garden District, right across the street from Commander's Palace. Two Chicks also offers several varieties of French Quarter tours, as well as tours of St. Louis Cemetery No. 1. Whatever you choose, know you'll be in great hands and you'll have a wonderful time. Use code BEYOND and save 15% over at twochickswalkingtours.com. We're almost to our discussion with Grayson Gill of Bellegarde Bakery, but the question I get asked most often these days is about moving to New Orleans. I get this email or text a couple times a week. My answer? Reach out to Liz Wood at Liz Wood Realty. I specifically wanted a realtor as a sponsor to help meet this very need. Liz and her team can help you find the right place, whether you plan to rent or purchase the home of your dreams. Look, New Orleans is a terrific city, but choosing the neighborhood that's the best fit for you, it can be overwhelming. Liz makes the process fun and easy, and she educates her clients along the way. Uptown, downtown, by the lake or near the river, mid-city, the 9th Ward, Liz can help you sort it all out. Reach out to her at lizwoodrealty.com and make your dream of living in New Orleans a reality. Several members of our community have already done just that, and they're thrilled with their new homes. You will be too. As we jump into today's discussion, you might notice the recording sounds just a little bit different than normal. We typically do our interviews in person, but Grayson was in California at the time of this recording, so we did a phone interview. I think you'll still love it. Hey, y'all. My guest today is an artisan in the truest sense. As you'll hear, he's so passionate about what he does. I'm particularly intrigued because he's a baker of bread in a city known for po' boys, but that's not his story. I'll let him tell us all about it. So without further ado, welcome to the podcast, Grayson Gill. How are you, Grayson?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much.
Hey, I am really excited to have you, and I appreciate it. I understand you're out on the West Coast today, but I appreciate you getting up early and joining us. Although I imagine as a baker, this actually isn't very early for you.
No, it's really not. But we'll make exceptions for everybody.
Thank you. So, as I mentioned, you're a baker. I want to get into your sort of story, but where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Los Angeles, about 20 miles south of Los Angeles, in a town called Redondo Beach. Mm-hmm. My mom's family left Belgium after World War II, and they immigrated here to California. And then my dad grew up in Chicago, and he moved out to California in the mid-70s. And then I left Redondo Beach when I was 17, and I went to school in New York for 2 years and got an associate's degree before dropping out. And I moved to Europe for a while, and then my best friend from high school, his mom is from Chalmette. And he and I were living together in Europe. And when we both came back to the States, he moved to New Orleans, and kind of pretty close behind him, I decided to move down there with him. And that was April 15th of 2009.
Wow.
And I had been down there before with my mom. I actually got a full ride to Tulane. So she and I had been there, I think it was 2004, 2005, to visit the school and check out the city. And I also, where I grew up in Redondo Beach was just an incredible kind of a cultural hot pot of different people. And I grew up with just a wonderful diversity of different adults and kids and my friend group and my best friend that lived right across the street from the house that I'm at now, which is my mom's house, were part of the Great Migration from Louisiana. So they were Black Louisiana Creoles. And that kind of lifestyle and who they were and just the things that we did with their three kids and in terms of cooking and being outside and whether it was like boxing in the streets or having barbecue or doing music and all that kind of stuff. It was something that since I was 11, it was what I was exposed to. So I know a lot of people that obviously fall in love with the culture of New mm-hmm. the social culture. They don't really know it or aren't familiar with it when they get there. And for me, it was just something that immediately upon arrival, it wasn't something that I fell in love with because it was something that I'd been familiar with since I was pretty much a child. And that's why everything down there is very comfortable for me in terms of, you know, social life and how people live, having that exposure as a kid to people from there.
Well, you've certainly jumped in and made yourself a part of the fabric, as we'll discuss. But when you got here, were you already interested in baking at that point?
Yeah, I started working with Macon Fry, who is a wonderful kind of urban farmer. And I was working at Holly Grove with him and doing a bunch of other kind of odd jobs. And I just started baking at our rented apartment on Royal Street. And things kind of snowballed where I got word of mouth kind of friend who had a friend who owned a commercial kitchen not too far from where we were living on Royal and Louisa at that time. So this guy owned this commercial kitchen that quite a few different chefs and other people were using for their catering or for whatever they were doing. And they had a huge oven in there. And I had no idea what to do with it, but I was given the opportunity to kind of move in, so to speak. So I think rent was maybe $200 a month, and I had no education about how to bake or what to do, but I was confident and just being disciplined and trying to learn more and more and do everything I could at least twice to get it down. So I moved from the production, so to speak, from my kind of roommate's kitchen in the back on Louisa to this commercial kitchen and started selling a little bit to neighbors. And I was selling at Holly Grove Market, and I was doing a farmer's market every other week as well. And I was at that commercial kitchen for about, about just shy of 2 years. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of hit a pivot in my life where I was falling in love more and more with baking, but I had absolutely no formal education about it. And the way that I was raised is that there's definitely a kind of a linear and hierarchical thing when it comes to craft in terms of learning from somebody that does something and they're going to impart you with experience and knowledge, as opposed to you just jump into doing something yourself and get it figured out. I really was thirsty for having that relationship with a mentor and having kind of a really firm educational foundation in baking, because baking is a craft, just like mm-hmm. being a mason or being a plumber or electrician. Like, there's rules that you can break, but you need to know the rules first before you decide to break them. And there was just nobody, there was no baker and there was no bakery in New Orleans that I felt comfortable that could provide that relationship for me or provide that experience for me. So I decided to go to a vocational baking school, and the best one that I found happened to be in Northern California. So I went there to enroll in a professional program that was like 50 hours a week. And then I was working on the weekends. So I was basically baking probably like 90 hours a week for like 6, 7, 8, 9 months. And then I was over there after graduation for about a year. And then I came back to New Orleans to open Bellegarde. And that was October of 2012.
Sure. And so tell me about a couple of things about Bellegarde specifically. So you guys had, I guess, your official opening on St. Joseph's Day in 2013, if I recall. Is that right?
That's exactly right. Yeah. I signed a lease January 2nd of 2013. And then I filed papers with the Louisiana Secretary of State for the bakery in October of 2012. But yeah, our very first sale was St. Joseph's Day of 2013.
And was that sort of just a coincidence, or was that particularly significant for you?
I don't know if I threw business away to make it significant to only start on that day, but knowing me, I probably did, because it's something that's always been incredibly important to me, being someone that most of the time identifies as a pretty secular Catholic, and just being in love with that tradition, and obviously the tradition that it holds for New Orleans and the meaning that it holds for New Orleans as well too. But I was I did a big altar for International House Hotel, mm-hmm. and I, from what I recall, it was probably serendipitous that it happened to be the first sale on St. Joseph's Day, but I'm sure that I kind of forced my hand a little bit at wanting it to be the first sale to be on that day. Yeah, it's an incredible tradition that's always intrigued me, and definitely got pretty heavy into doing altars for, it was I think 13, 14, and 15, and definitely put a lot into doing it, and not doing anything this year for a few different reasons, but sure. It's something that I care tremendously about, and it's a beautiful, beautiful ritual that we have in New Orleans.
For listeners who maybe don't realize it, I think most do, New Orleans is overwhelmingly Catholic, and St. Joseph's Day holds a special place in the city for so many reasons, but among them are that lots of Sicilians immigrated to New Orleans and celebrate St. Joseph and honor him with the altars, as you described, or big dinners for family and friends. But the baking, as we'll get into more and more, plays such a role, the special breads that are made that day and the shapes and all of that. Not to mention, you mentioned growing up in a diverse community that really sort of embraced and knew the traditions of New Orleans. St. Joseph's Day is a big part of the African-American community here, with the Mardi Gras Indians, who pay homage to the Native American Indians on St. Joseph's Day night, as well as to the Sicilian immigrants, all of whom played a role in helping slaves and former slaves as they tried to escape and tried to make a better life for themselves. So I just thought it was sort of an amazing kind of confluence of events that for whatever reason, that became the day of your first official sale as a business. Tell me about the name Bellegarde and how it came, why you chose it, and what the significance is.
Bellegarde is the name of the first recorded bakery in Louisiana. So the capital of French Louisiana kind of jumped around from Biloxi to Mobile, and they were in Mobile for about 20 years, I think. And then in 1718, they decided to move the capital of French Louisiana from Mobile to New Orleans, and there was a baker whose first name was Francois, and he was operating a bakery there for, I think, 20 years under the name Bellegarde in Mobile. And when the administration decided to leave, he left with them. And I think the first commercial recording of when he opened in New Orleans was on the 1722, and the bakery was on St. Anne and Charter Street. So it's where the Pentabla is now. and then he was open. I also read that he was a wine merchant, and he was a real estate broker or a real estate merchant as well. And he was open for about 6 years on St. Anne and Charters, and then he got busted for selling loaves that were not at the described weight of sale. So what they would do with that is they would take all of your bread and throw it in the river, and that was basically a statement that you were no longer welcome to be open for business anymore. So he had a pretty like illustrious, lucrative career, and then kind of ruined it at the end of things by being cheap and undercutting people. But I chose the name because I just don't think naming something after yourself can communicate anything. I think it's kind of egotistical and silly, and I just don't know what it comes across as to say, you know, like Grayson's Breeders is something kind of absurd like that. So when searching for a name, I wanted something that had some sort of tether and some sort of texture, I think, to who we are and what we do. And when I came across this name, Bellegarde, the very first bakery in Louisiana, I thought that there wasn't anything more perfect to choose as our name, because of course a lot of our equipment is different, but I really don't think that our ingredients are too different, and I definitely don't think that our methods are very different from the first bakery that operated in New Orleans about 300 years ago. So when I came across that name in the historical library at Tulane at the Tilton Library, I really didn't think twice about knowing that was what I wanted to choose. And I actually coincidentally, because everything in New Orleans is either coincidence or serendipity, I have two very close friends whose eighth grandfather removed was Bellegarde, wow, was this baker. So that's something that's also really cool too, and that I love.
Well, it just struck me as well that it really kind of ties into the mission of what you do and your thought process on how to make the products that you make. And what I mean by that, that's a good segue, I think, of you seem very, and your whole team seems very focused on back to the roots, sort of farm to table, very straightforward ingredients. Can you talk to me just a little bit about that, about what's different about Bellegarde and the approach that you all take to crafting the bread that you make?
Definitely the menu is very small. So we make, you know, like four or five types of bread 6 days a week. We don't do any pastry. We don't do any cakes. We don't do anything except four types of bread 6 days a week. And the menu has changed a little bit since we opened 6 years ago, but the premise of how we make things and what we make has changed or very, very little, because I worked in enough places as a kid that you have this huge menu of different breads or different foods or different products. And basically what happens is staff become burned out on making too much stuff, because the more things that you make, I feel like the less you're able to care and focus on them. And my goal was never to make pastries or donuts or cakes or things that aren't close to my heart, because I fell in love with bread and I'm still in love with bread, and there's no reason that I should have to make anything else. And there's a big issue, I think, not just in New Orleans, but around the country, where you have chefs that don't respond to bread as an ingredient that they respond to like other things. So for example, a chef would never go to a winemaker and tell them that they wanted a certain wine, a certain flavor, a certain color, a certain texture. They would never go to the oyster fisherman and say, I want an oyster of a certain flavor, certain color, certain texture. They would never go to the tomato farmer and say the same thing. But yet when it comes to bread, they think of bread as a very stable product that kind of moves through time regardless of the cuisine or regardless of other things that are going on in cooking, not just trends but just advancements in how we eat and what we eat. So you have people that are still interested in, you know, serving a hamburger bun, or they want, you know, po' boy bread, or they want things that don't move parallel to the advancement of our cuisine. So you have this trend that I think is deeper than a trend when it comes to farm-to-table ingredients, or when it comes to what would be called identity-preserved ingredients. So that means that an oyster, you know where an oyster is coming from. The identity of that oyster is preserved, or you know that strawberry is from Ponchatoula. Mm-hmm. You know that Creole tomato is from Bellechase. And what we're doing at Bellegarde is bringing that concept into the bakery. So we know where about 60% of our flour and our grain comes from, because we mill it ourselves. We actually buy the salt directly from the salt mine in Avery Island, which is pretty unprecedented. So we're not using anonymous salt. We're using salt directly from the producer. Our heirloom corn has been grown by the same family in southern Alabama since 1875. We buy our corn directly from them. And then all of our wheats and our rye and our other grains that we buy are also coming directly from the people that produce them. So that retains not just integrity, and not only does it add a lot of value to those people economically because we're buying grains on a direct market as opposed to buying it through a middleman, but it just preserves the huge integrity of flavor. So people that are operating their restaurants on these principles of ingredients that have their identity preserved, they think nothing of that when it comes to the bread. And that's what we've been advocating, not necessarily since the beginning of the bakery opening, but definitely the past 4 and 5 years, it's become more and more and more important to us. And I definitely see a point in the future where there's nothing in our bakery that we don't know where it's coming from. And there's very, very few things on our list that we don't know where they're coming from. We're buying organic pecans that are being grown in Bowbridge. We're buying a single origin identity preserved olive oil from San Antonio, Texas. And we're buying our figs directly from the producer as well, too, for bread that we make. So there's very, very few things on our menu right now that we don't have an origin story for. And the goal for me and the goal for everybody else in the bakery is to completely close that loop within a year and a half. So there's nothing in that bakery that we don't know who it's coming from and where it's coming from. And there's definitely not another bakery in Louisiana that has anything on that, let alone really anybody in the country on our scale that's doing anything of on that level. I think there's definitely a few smaller bakeries that have that ability to buy locally, but nobody on the scale that we're operating on is advocating or pushing or really realizing that change.
Sure. Well, there's a lot to unpack there. And as a consumer and a lover of New Orleans food, I think one of the things you hit on is it's been, I guess, a trend or a change. As you said, if you go to a nice restaurant today, they can sort of tell you, here's where the steak came from. It's on the menu, right? Here's where the steak came
right
from. Here's where the cheese was sourced from. But then you just got bread. And this is in a city that loves their bread and loves tradition. And that's one of the things about Bellegarde. When you see your products in restaurants, and we'll talk about that in a minute, it has that same kind of lineage. So you know where it's from. And you kind of just jump through in your laundry list about the corn for the grits. So you guys grind everything. And I want to ask you about that in a minute. But I got to tell you, I am somebody that loves grits. We have for, gosh, a decade and a half ordered stone ground grits. But the Bellegarde grits have like converted me completely. And now those are the grits in our home because there's a nuttiness to them and a texture and a freshness to them that we've never
right
tasted anywhere else. And I think that comes through in all of your breads and the products that you guys make.
Well, thank you very much. And I'm glad that you recognize that. And I think just to make it clear for people that don't, you know, aren't in the food business or aren't like huge foodies, that what you and I are talking about when it comes to these ingredients or coming to the terroir of these ingredients, all you need to do is look at a wine menu at any restaurant. And that's everything that I'm talking about. Because a wine menu, when you open it up, it tells you the name of the producer, what variety of grape was used, where it was made, and when it was made. And everything that we consume, everything that we grow has that fingerprint. But when it comes to bread, we have no conception of where it's coming from, not just the bread itself, but the flour. And that's everything that we're advocating for at Bellegarde, is to say, why don't we treat grains and wheat and corn in the same way that La Petite Grocery has a wine menu on their table? We should have that same thing for grains. Whether it's on a table, I don't know if that's necessary, but definitely in the bakery and definitely for a chef, we should have some sort of fingerprint and identity behind where these grains and where these flours and where these wheats are coming from.
And you certainly have found a receptive audience among the chef community here in the city. I think about Alon Shaya, Nina Compton. I'm actually recording this from the old 77 Hotel. They're one of our sponsors of the show. And I know Nina, Isaac Toops, Dickie Brennan as well. So among
yep
others, you have really found a connection with well-known, well-regarded chefs.
Emeril's been a huge supporter as well, too.
La Boca comes to mind, Adolfo Garcia over there. But all of those places, all of those chefs have a similar focus in their overall menu and their approach. I think about Isaac Toups and the real sort of being able to source down to the farmer and being able to tell the story so that not only do you taste those flavors, but the story behind what appears on your plate and how much work goes into presenting a meal or a loaf of bread in front of a customer.
Exactly.
And I recently saw or read an article where Chef Shia was talking about that thing. And as I understand, there's a connection between him and your team, that you have a member of your team, at least one, that has direct roots to his organization. Is that correct?
Yeah, Morgan Angel is from Brobridge, and she's been in New Orleans for, I think, about 12 years. And she was the manager and the head baker at Pizza Dominica for about 4 years. And then she joined Bellegarde about 2 years ago.
And certainly Shia has a just as intense a focus or a passion, I would say, about that connection to community that I hear in your voice. And
absolutely. Yeah, it took him... he's been, I think, above everybody that supported us, which has been a pretty huge list of people, I don't think that I would be who I am today or where I am today if it weren't for the support of Nina and if it weren't for the support of Alon. And there's something that's no longer happening, but there was an event called the Grain Gathering that was held a little bit north of Seattle every summer. And I managed Vince Alon to attend this event about 3 or 4 years ago, and he had 2 friends that are pretty big chefs that are very big chefs that were all attending. So I think that I want to always remember in my memory that it was my passionate argument that he should come with me. But I realized it was probably the fact that his friends Mark and Chris were there. But anyway, it was a conference about everything that we're talking about now, that grains have terroir and grains have identity and grains have flavor and texture and aroma, just like coffee and just like wine and just like oysters, et cetera, et cetera. But I'll never forget the look on his face, because I'm always up early, but they were doing field tours to walk in the wheat fields at dawn, right before harvest. And for some reason, I wanted to get some rest, and I chose not to wake up at 4:30 in the morning to do this walk through the fields. And I know that he was having a gradual epiphany throughout the conference. And as I did wake up that day at 6 or 7 and I went down to the conference, which was in the fields, to get coffee, I ran into him, and the look on his face, he did tell me that if he didn't understand it before, then he definitely got it now. But having done that wheat field walk at dawn with the head wheat breeder in Washington, I think changed his cooking life forever. And I don't think he's ever looked back since. And everything that I had been trying to talk to him and explain to him, I think basically either congealed or went out the window, because all of it made sense when he saw it in that field that morning. And that was a big pivot, not just, I think, in our relationship, but in the way that he talks about food now, because that's something that really opened up a door in his mind that many, many chefs want to keep closed. And it was not something that he intended to keep closed, but there's very few bakers that treat flour as an ingredient, and even fewer chefs that treat flour as an ingredient. But it's been more than a blessing that he's come along for the ride, and that he sees it and that he gets it.
So tell me, and I should mention, we're recording this in March of 2019, and you were just featured in the Food and Wine article in their Makers issue. And one of the things you talked about there, and you alluded to it just now talking about Shia, is, why do you mill your own grain instead of purchasing flour?
Well, I just want to be clear that at this point in time, we still do purchase flour. There's a lot of different reasons for that, but mostly it's financial. But we still buy and we still use white flour. It's not something I want to be doing forever, but it's just, I think, because of where we are, it's something that we have to continue to do for, I think, not forever, but definitely for a little bit more time, because the goal for all of us is that we're only going to be using flour that we're able to mill ourselves in-house. Mm-hmm. So we're milling about 2,000 pounds of flour a week right now. And then when we're moving to Apple Street, we'll be getting a second flour mill. So we'd be doubling our capacity and hopefully mm-hmm. doubling our use of flour too. But it's the same reason that a chef would want to order in a whole animal and have somebody butcher that animal in house in the same way that they do that at Cochon. It's just because you want to have an intimacy and a relationship to the ingredients that you're using. And it's unlike cooking where you have many, many ingredients going into a dish. When you're talking about bread, you have three ingredients. You have flour, you have water, and you have salt. So we've been sourcing salt directly from the salt mine for 4 years. The water is filtered, you know, New Orleans public water. And then there's flour. So to me, the epiphany for me was, if I'm focusing on all these other ingredients in the bakery, whether that's pecans or olive oil or figs or whatever it may be, why am I not focusing on the flour? And it basically put myself, I put myself in a corner when I couldn't answer that question, nor could anybody else provide an answer to that question in the form of flour that I wanted to use. So I was basically forced to mill my own flour, because there was nobody around me, around New Orleans, doing that. So I wanted to use the freshest possible flour in the same way that a chef wants to use the freshest possible produce. And there was nobody doing that. And I basically decided to buy a mill and to do that myself. And that's definitely become a rabbit hole that everybody at Bellegarde has jumped down, kind of holding hands together. And there were definitely some hard parts in the middle, and the beginning of that journey, so to speak, in terms of, I'll never forget having and watching a 2,000 pound bag of wheat spill in the middle of Toledano Street in April. And I've never had to sweep up so much stuff in my life. And I used to work on like a movie set as a kid. So I used to have to sweep movie sets. And that was, I thought that was bad, but sweeping up 2,000 pounds of spilled wheat was 10,000 times worse than anything you can hope upon a worst enemy. But I mean, it's all part of the game. And you can only, I think the only way to succeed is to fail. And I failed, and I didn't make bad decisions. I made stupid decisions because I had no frame of reference on how to make a good one. And I had no one to help me. And everyone at Bellegarde has also fallen down that path with me as well too, where when we receive wheat, or when we have relationships with farmers now, or the amount of farmers and people that we have wanting to grow stuff for us now, it's completely night and day, because we're basically oversaturated with places where we can go or where we can get it. Whereas 6 years ago, it took fighting tooth and nail to get where we are today, to have this portfolio of different growers and farmers and other people that we want to work with. And I continue to have a terrible relationship with LSU because they just don't see the value in what we're doing and what we're talking about. And I mean, it was beautiful and it was vindicating, and I'm very thankful for being on the cover of Food and Wine magazine, but I still would almost trade that for anything if we could just get somebody at LSU to listen to what it is that we're doing and what it is that we're talking about, because we're not talking about something out of left field. We're talking about something very, very tangible when it comes to a local food economy. And yet you continue to have people in Baton Rouge that really could care less, particularly at LSU, when it comes to asking these questions, why can't we do this a little bit more closer to home? And it's a romance. I mean, I believe in love at first sight. And when I saw and when I tasted and when I smelled freshly milled flour, it was love at first sight. And every single baker that walks through the door of our bakery, and every single chef, I think, that buys our bread, whether they are going to be buying our bread forever, or whether they make other decisions, I don't think they're ever going to forget the fragrance of our bread or the quality of our bread because of that fresh flour that we're milling. And that's the goal for me.
Well, and I think one of the direct ties into Louisiana is, you know, we're the sportsman's paradise, and we have such a wealth of things here, whether it is game or the rice or the staples. But when you start to think about, to me, the difference between your bread, it's sort of like the first time you eat fish that have just been caught, or the first time you eat a bell pepper that was grown in your neighbor's backyard or in a community garden.
Exactly.
Right. And that's for people kind of wondering, gosh, why are we going on about grain? To me, that's the difference. When you take a bite
of your
bread, freshly made, you can taste those nuances, the textures, the freshness that you just don't get when you buy a commercial product that's been, engineered for a commercial, you know, for going through the produce, through the cycle chain into a supermarket and all those sorts of things.
That's exactly it. And I think people need to understand that white flour is a product that's been on a shelf, whether it's at a supermarket or whether it's in a commercial bakery. That flour was grown and milled and stored and transported years ago from the date that it was grown and harvested. And we're dealing with stuff that we're putting in the mill and that we're using within 4 days of milling it fresh. And that's kind of the culprit, so to speak, of all the aroma, all the flavor, and also the nutritional benefits of eating our bread is because of that fresh and milled flour. And we don't need to get into it now, but you touched on it in terms of the value chain. It means a lot more to me in terms of my political beliefs to be able to spend $200,000 a year on ingredients and give those checks directly to the people that make those foods, as opposed to cutting a check to a middleman who's, you know, kind of skimming and taking. And they provide an important role in the economy, but I think it makes a deeper, more long-term social and economic change when I can buy and give money directly to the people that are making our food, as opposed to going to a third party. And that's something that's deeply important to me as well.
Sure. And as you've highlighted, you have such a wealth, both in Louisiana, but across the country, really, of small farmers or small people, you know, small businesses working hard to do that. And those connections, for instance, you mentioned a couple of times, the Avery Island salt. In a coming episode, we're going to do a story about Avery Island and about Tabasco. But I venture to say a lot of my listeners don't even know that Tabasco is made on Avery Island, and that is sitting on top of these massive salt domes. And so I right. believe you're the only other commercial enterprise besides Tabasco that is sourcing Avery Island salt directly like that. Isn't that right?
As far as I know, yeah. They've been. We worked with Took McElhenney, who I got a contact through Susan Manick, who mm-hmm. just opened a beautiful new store in Carrollton. It was just one more. And I mean, the McElhenney family and everybody that's working at Tabasco has been incredible in terms of allowing us to do this. But I just had one of these epiphanies where I ordered salt and I got like salt from whatever, California, it said on the big bag. And I'm here in New Orleans using this salt from California in my bakery, and I'm just like, this is absurd. Why can't I have access to something that's next to me? And it wasn't simply a phone call. It definitely took years and years of kind of like lobbying and talking and trying to get it all sorted out, but it's worth it because I just inherently believe that you shouldn't be using something. If it's available locally, you absolutely should not be using something that's produced or grown far away. And that's become the economy that we're dealing with now on many levels, but I just feel like morally it's reprehensible, and I think ethically it's unacceptable that we should be using ingredients that are grown or harvested thousands of miles away from where we live in New Orleans, because the beauty of New Orleans is the food, and the food, the cuisine was founded on ingredients that were only available locally, and they were only available because of the synthesis of all the different cultures that contributed to building New Orleans. But we've gotten to a point in time where we're making jambalaya with rice that's grown in California or Texas, or we're making gumbo with shrimp that was harvested in Vietnam or in Thailand, or crawfish that was made in China. And I mean, this is absurd. It's not our cuisine if we're not using local ingredients to make it. And I think that everybody has a culpability in getting away from using and supporting local ingredients. And I would hope that there's stronger leadership from chefs, from bakers like us, and I think most importantly from local government to realize that there's a huge amount of money in local food because people have to eat and people spend a bunch of money on food, whether it's eating out or shopping at a supermarket. And if we can harvest a little bit more of a change in, on the policy level when it comes to supporting local growers on a larger scale, I think it can really provide a groundswell, not just for our public health, but also for the flavor of our cuisine. Because I doubt that there's one person that wouldn't agree that the flavor in the food is definitely not gotten better the past 20, 30, 40 years as we've seen these changes kind of occur. And that's a big goal and a big dream of mine is to have more local ingredients become more accessible, not just to chefs and bakers in New Orleans, but to the general public as well, too.
Well, and that kind of takes us full circle to, you mentioned early on in the conversation, Grayson, that you used to sell at the Holly Grove Market, and now you guys are about to move into a new location pretty close to the Holly Grove Market over on Apple Street. So tell me a little bit about the plans there, and for our listeners, just kind of geographically, where the new place is going to be.
it's basically on the corner of Claiborne and Carrollton. So I suppose I would call that kind of mid-city. But because we're in the delivery business, it's great for us because I didn't want to move to Magazine or move downtown where the rents are exorbitant. Mm-hmm. And that's probably a different podcast to talk about that. But we found this gorgeous, gorgeous building that was built in about 1910. And then most recently, and I say that with a grain of salt because it's been vacant since the mid-90s, but most recently it was a Knights of Columbus Hall. Mm-hmm. But it's a beautiful kind of Spanish colonial architecture with a gorgeous tile roof and then a gigantic awning on the front of the building and huge, huge, about 4 by 10 foot windows kind of perforate the walls and the sides of the building. So it's a beautiful 3,200 square foot facility. It's got wonderful exposed ceilings, about 20 feet high. And we're going to be offering, as we still do now, but we're going to be offering classes there. We're going to be having retail, so people will be able to come in and buy flour. They'll be able to come and buy bread. We're going to have very simple coffee service. We're going to be partnering with Congregation Coffee, which is a local coffee roastery in Algiers. They're going to be doing our drip coffee. And then we're probably going to continue to add some things to the menu as time goes on. But to start, we're just going to be opening with bread for sale, flour, and then coffee. And we're all just incredibly excited. I opened the bakery with the SBA check when I was 25 years old, and I had no idea what was going to happen or not happen. And I didn't want to get in over my head financially by moving to a beautiful building and things were not going to pan out. So I kind of worked my way up from debt and from being alone and to not knowing what was going to happen to where we are 6 years later of having a staff of 17 and having the recognition that we do. And it definitely was high time that we move into a facility that I think the goal for a facility for me was that the facility would always match the aesthetic of what we do. So something that's full of light, something that has no walls, because everything that we do is transparent. Everything that we do is traceable. That was very important for me to have a place where you could come and see who we are and what we do, because that's what the bread is about. There's nothing but flour, water, and salt in our bread. And I don't want anything to get in between who we are as craftspeople and what we're doing in our building as well, too. And Apple Street is going to be a perfect estimation of what that looks like aesthetically. Just wide open windows in a wide open space where you can see who we are and you can see what we do. And as things go with construction, we're looking at a pretty firm move-in date of mid to late May. And then we're going to be doing a big opening party probably about mid-June. And thankfully and wonderfully, our very first class is going to be a class with Alon Shaya. And that's going to be on June 9th. So we're also bringing that full circle to have our very first public class be with one of our very greatest benefactors. And that's going to be on June 9th. But we're all incredibly excited and everything is lined up and we're all ready to go for Apple Street.
Well, as you and I were talking before we started recording, I am particularly excited because we live very, very close, easy walking distance.
Best in interest.
Yeah, so we will be able to walk down the street and go get my grits. So that's exciting. But I also love that the new location is in a neighborhood. Longtime listeners know right. I grew up in a po' boy restaurant in a place called Teddy's Grill in Gentilly, and the thing that we miss most dearly, my parents and I and my brother and sister, is being a part of the community. And that's what you guys are going to be right there on Apple Street, right embedded in a neighborhood where people can walk and also probably learn and benefit from the business in the neighborhood there.
Yeah, that's a great point that you raised that I guess I overlooked to some extent because I'm focused on all my stuff. And I think that's super meaningful. And we have, there's a wonderful church right across the street and there's a small day school as well. So it's just going to be, I mean, we love being on Toledano and yep. the old Gambinos right now, but it's definitely not like pull up a chair and spend time with folks kind of in that neck of the woods. But
sure.
Moving to Apple is definitely going to be that atmosphere. And that's, as we talked about and as your podcast is all about, New Orleans is lubricated by food and stories.
Yep.
And being able to be ingrained in that neighborhood, I think, is only going to add a little bit more oil to the engine of the food and the stories that, that take place in New Orleans. So that's a great perspective that you brought up. So thank you.
Sure. And I should mention, we'll put all the links to all the ways to connect with you guys and to find out about what's going on. We'll put it over in the show notes for the for this episode, which will be beyondbourbonst.com/85. People can find you guys at bellegardebakery.com. They can whet their appetite on your gorgeous Instagram page at Bellegarde Bakery. And again, we'll put all the links. The other thing I want to mention for people that aren't here or maybe just not thinking about it is the new location on Apple Street. You'll be able to take the St. Charles streetcar right to the end, right there at the end of Claiborne and Carrollton, and then walk, gosh, it's just three short blocks, I would say, to the new location. So it'll also be accessible if people are visiting. You know, it's really going to be great, I think, all the way around. Plus, it allows you, I think you mentioned, you're going to be able to, like, basically double your capacity, right?
Yeah, in terms of what we're going to be able to sell and produce as well, too. Yeah, that's a wonderful point. And then we have a lot of great things kind of up our sleeve to be adding down the line as well, too. So hopefully people can look forward to pizza nights. We would love to do a guest chef series or
sure.
some sort of maybe like a farmer lecture. We'd love to bring in some of our farmers to have them meet the people that they feed, because this is something in America that we're not really, you know, acclimated to anymore, is meeting the people that make our food. So I think the possibilities are endless, and the streetcar is a great option to get up there.
Yeah. Well, Grayson, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today and to share your story and your love of grain and flour and bringing it to the table here in New Orleans and beyond.
It's my pleasure, Mark. Thank you so much.
Hey, I hope you enjoyed the discussion with Grayson. The idea for this episode came from my wife, Marie. When Bellegarde first came on the scene, I wasn't so sure. I mean, I love our po' boy bread here in New Orleans. However, I've come to look for and really enjoy Bellegarde's product. Their bread has a real flavor and a texture all its own. I also love it even more now that I know the story and Grayson's focus on tracing the raw ingredients. And as you heard, I love their grits. If you love gristmill grits, by the way, do yourself a favor and try these. As we discussed during the episode, you can purchase Bellegarde products online, and come summer of 2019, you'll be able to visit their retail shop in front of the bakery on Apple Street, New Orleans. We'll put links to everything Bellegarde in the show notes over at beyondbourbonst.com/85.
If you're enjoying the podcast, please share it with someone who loves New Orleans. New episodes are available every other Wednesday. Until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.